thank you very much. I hope you're all still having a good day. We are going to begin this plenary, which will be in three parts. First, with the announcement of some commitments. I'd like to begin by asking Susan Arnold, the Vice Chairman of Procter & Gamble, to come up here. Their commitment is that Procter & Gamble will partner with the Children's Safe Drinking Partners and 20 other organizations to provide clean drinking water to reduce severe diarrhea and childhood death in 13 nations in Africa, Asia, and the Caribbean. In addition, working with UNICEF through its Pampers brand, P&G will contribute to the elimination of maternal and neonatal tetanus by supporting UNICEF's procurement of close to 45 million tetanus vaccines. This is worth about $20 million over 5 years for safe drinking water, another $2 million for the tetanus vaccine commitment. I'd just like to remind those of you who were here last year that at last year's meeting, P&G partnered with others to provide safe drinking water and hygiene education to 1 million children in Africa, 135 million liters of safe drinking water from PUR practices by two packets by 2009. And to date, in keeping their last year's commitment, they have already reached 200,000 children, and they're actually on track to exceed these goals. Now, building on that commitment, P&G and their partner organizations are going to provide an additional 2 billion liters of safe drinking water by 2012. It will save an estimated 10,000 lives. And this tetanus initiative will procure 45 million tetanus vaccines for use in developing countries. Each package of Pampers will cover the cost of one shot. So for those of you still of an age and a family circumstance, I urge you to go support this. Thank you so much, Susan. Let's give her a big hand. Thank you very, very much. Now I'd like to invite to the stage Betsy Taylor, the chair of One Sky, Stephen Heinz, the president of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, Jesse Fink, the managing director of Mission Point Capital Partners. They have another partner, the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. I don't know if their president, Van Jones, is here, but if he is, I hope he'll come up. Hello.
How are you doing, man?
You did great on that coastal open. That's good. Thanks. Their commitment is to bring together a broad range of corporate and nonprofit partners to develop a national call for action on climate change. It is valued at $50 million, and here's how it will work. One Sky will lead a broad coalition to develop and push the United States government to deliver sweeping climate change solutions. They will execute a communications and field campaign with the objective of convincing the United States to match the European Union commitments on climate change. In March of 2007, the European Union agreed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 20% below 1990 levels, to increase the use of renewable energy to 20% of all energy consumed, to increase energy efficiency by 20%. You may remember on the morning panel when Vice President Gore was here and we were discussing this, I believe I said, and if I didn't, I'm going to say it for the first time. We had a young man I know who works for Goldman Sachs gave me a study that the company had commissioned, which said if the United States simply reaches the energy efficiency levels of Japan and China, India, and Russia do the same, we will reduce greenhouse gas emissions globally by 20%. This is a big deal for all of us to be pursuing the same goal. And if, particularly since we have now an enormous amount of energy in the American investment community in getting all major carbon emitters to report their carbon footprint. Merrill Lynch is leading the effort in America this year, but investors with total portfolios of $41 trillion are now involved in this, and all the major European companies, 75% are participating, 60% of the American companies up from 47% last year. So we actually have a chance to get this done, and that's why this commitment is so important. I think all of you know that 2006 was the hottest year on record in the United States, and in case you were paying attention, when I got out of the airplane yesterday afternoon coming back from the 50th anniversary of the Little Rock Central High School crisis in my home state, and I landed at Westchester Airport in the early evening, it was 6 degrees warmer than it had been at noon that day, and we're reaching another historically warm week here. We've got a lot of states doing what they should do. We've got a lot of interest in the federal government in increased R&D, but we don't have a national goal, and we don't have a real policy to try to bring us into alignment in the results we achieve. So I am personally very, very grateful to One Sky, to the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, to Mission Point Capital Partners, to Jonathan Rose Companies, and the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. And I would like to present this commitment to them and thank them and ask you to give them a hand. Now, this next commitment, in my view, alone justifies the decision we made this year to have a separate track on education. And, of course, this plenary will involve a fascinating discussion of education ideas after we do phase two. That's phase three. So this is the last commitment I'm going to announce. In my view, this is something that demonstrates, as well as anything else CGI will do this year, what this conference is about getting people together and leveraging our various resources and strengths to really change lives. In 2006, Angelina Jolie and my former National Economic Advisor, Gene Sperling, who now runs the Center for Universal Education at the Council on Foreign Relations, agreed to co-chair a new education partnership for children of conflict. The partnership's goal is to help fund new education projects for children in conflict, post-conflict, refugee, and emergency situations, which will be announced every year here at CGI. Their first year has had an inspiring start. 18 commitments in places from Iraq to Colombia to northern Uganda to Afghanistan to Darfur. There's no doubt that by expanding and improving access to education, we can have a profound impact on some of the world's most vulnerable children. This is a commitment that showcases perfectly the commitment of this meeting to getting results and not just talking about problems. I'd like to give you an idea of the scope and impact of these 18 projects and how they help fund new education projects for children in conflict, post-conflict, refugee, and emergency situations. And this cost $150 million. Consider the combined impact of these investments. Specifically, UNICEF, along with Microsoft, the International Rescue Committee, and Hewlett-Packard, will launch a $30 million distance learning initiative to help 150,000 children, including children from the Iraq conflict and children in the occupied Palestinian territories. The International Rescue Committee is expanding its Healing Classrooms initiative to help 70,000 children in Afghanistan and 41,000 affected by Darfur. Save the Children Alliance will expand education programs in places like Jordan and Lebanon to serve Iraqi refugees and in Darfur and southern Sudan. The Sesame Workshop is committed to launch Sesame Street, Afghanistan. You guys are supposed to come up here, as I mentioned, your groups. Sesame Street, Afghanistan, to teach Afghan children not only to read, but to understand words like tolerance and reconciliation. The American Jewish World Service is committed to raise over $2 million to support education in Darfur, Sri Lanka, Burma, and Guatemala. The Norwegian Refugee Council will expand its accelerated learning programs to serve over 100,000 out-of-school youth in southern Sudan and Iraqi refugees in Lebanon and Syria. The Children's Investment Fund Foundation has committed an additional $3 million to expand the International Rescue Committee's education work in northern Uganda. Unbound Philanthropy is committed to fund $500,000 in projects developed through the partnership. The Escuela Nueva Foundation will spread its philosophy of holistic child-centered education to nearly 9,000 children in conflict-affected areas of Colombia. The Center for Mind-Body Medicine will provide psychological counseling and support to 25,000 school children traumatized by the conflict in Gaza to allow them to learn effectively in the classroom. The GSM Association is working with the United Nations Commissioner for Human Rights or Refugees to bring wireless connectivity to help train teachers and improve learning in northern Uganda. The High Commissioner for Refugees, in partnering with Nike, Microsoft, WPP, and others, is using the global initiative to relaunch 9million.org, a grassroots internet portal designed to help provide education and sports to all refugee children. The Valentino Achak Dong Foundation has committed $1.2 million to build a boarding school in southern Sudan. And he is here, and the hero of Dave Eggers' magnificent book, What is What? So I want to particularly recognize Mr. Dong here. Give him a hand. Bless you. Thank you. We have up here on this stage representatives of every group I have mentioned, and I'd now like to invite the co-chairs of the Education Partnership for Children in Conflict, Gene Sperling and Angelina Jolie, here. Let me remind you, as they come up to receive this certificate, these people have really done a lot, but remember the title of the website. There are 9 million displaced children who cannot go to school because of things that happened to them and their families that were completely beyond their control. So if any of you want to do something good and you came here and hadn't decided what to support, look at this. You know you've got a network here of people who will get a very high rate of return at a high rate of efficiency, and we've got still a breathtaking number of children to reach. But in the meanwhile, let's give them all a hand for doing something profoundly good. Now, before we do our plenary, we're going to hear a brief address from a person I'm very glad to welcome here, the Minister of Foreign Affairs of China, Yang Jiqi. He wanted to be here this morning when we were discussing climate change. No nation has a bigger stake in trying to deal with this in a way that does not interrupt its economic progress. And I personally have enjoyed working with the Minister of Foreign Affairs and with the Chinese Ministry of Health because our foundation runs a major AIDS project there all over the country. And it's been incredibly rewarding. Before he became the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Foreign Minister Yang was Vice Minister of Foreign Affairs, and before that, he was the Ambassador of China to the United States from 2001 to 2005. I think he waited until I left because he was afraid I would talk his ear off. We are deeply honored to have him here. I am particularly grateful for the work that he has done to try to help resolve a very difficult crisis with regard to North Korea and the nuclear issue, and for the receptivity that he has had to trying to change the United Nations policy on Darfur to make it more effective and save lives. And of course, because of the support of the government of China, we are able to save a lot of lives from HIV and AIDS. I've rarely seen a country change its position so rapidly and so effectively to the benefit of its children. So, Foreign Minister Yang, please come up, and ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Foreign Minister of China.
President Clinton, ladies and gentlemen, dear friends, it's a great pleasure for me to attend the 2007 annual meeting of the Clinton Global Initiative at the invitation of President Clinton. President Clinton has in recent years made admirable efforts to promote international cooperation on poverty alleviation, disaster relief, and the prevention and treatment of HIV/AIDS. The Clinton Global Initiative, sponsored by President Clinton, addresses many issues, including sustainable development, poverty alleviation, health, education, and climate change, and is important in boosting international cooperation in resolving these global issues that concern the interests of all countries. I greatly appreciate this initiative taken by President Clinton. Here I would like to speak on the topic of economic development and climate change. By the way, this time I've come for the UN General Assembly session, and climate change features prominently during the session. And I'm very glad to have this opportunity to be in your midst. And thank you for giving me this stage. Ladies and gentlemen, we live in an age of deepening economic globalization, increasing scientific and technological innovations, an unprecedented opportunity for human development. On the other hand, global economic development is confronted with many challenges, particularly mounting pressure on energy and resources and acute ecological degradation. Global warming, rising sea level, extreme weather, and weather-related natural disasters caused by climate change are adversely affecting the natural ecological system and the human habitat. Climate change has become a pressing challenge for the international community. A review of history shows that climate change occurred in the course of development. It is both an environment issue and a development issue. But ultimately, it is a development issue. As pointed out in the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, most of historical and current global emissions of greenhouse gases originated in developed countries, while per capita emissions in developing countries are still relatively low. The share of global emissions originating in developing countries will grow as they work to meet their social and development needs. To prevent climate change from endangering human survival and development, while maintaining economic development and meeting the legitimate demand of the people, this is an issue that concerns the well-being and the future of all mankind. Economic development and environmental protection and efforts to tackle climate change should be mutually reinforcing rather than mutually conflicting. For developing countries like China, whose level of economic development is still low and whose people are yet to live a better life, the most pressing issue for them is to grow the economy and raise people's living standards. Efforts to tackle climate change should promote economic development and not be pursued at the expense of economic development. On the other hand, we must not fail to see that an economic development model of high energy consumption, high pollution, and high emissions is not sustainable. And the path of pursuing development first and treating pollution next is not a viable one. The best environment policy is also the best economic policy. Countries should all incorporate. Thank you. Countries should all incorporate environmental protection into their overall economic development strategies and take resolute measures to follow a path of sustainable development. This will enable us to address environment issues through economic development and promote economic development by resolving environment issues, thus ensuring both economic development and environmental protection. Ladies and gentlemen, China will remain the largest developing country for a long time to come, and there are imbalances between urban and rural areas, among different regions, and between economic and social development. Its per capita GDP is behind the 100th place globally, and there are still over 20 million poor rural people, and more than 22 million urban residents receive basic living allowances. China is faced with the daunting task of growing its economy and eliminating poverty. The Chinese government, with a strong sense of responsibility to the Chinese people and people of the world, takes climate change seriously and has taken concrete measures to tackle it. At the APEC Economic Leaders Meeting in Sydney earlier this month, President Hu Jintao reaffirmed China's position on climate change and spoke on the forceful measures it has adopted in addressing climate change. A national leading group on climate change headed by Premier Wen Jiabao has been set up, and China has promulgated a series of related laws and regulations. It released the National Program on Climate Change in June, the first developing country to do so. China has contributed its share to reducing global greenhouse gas emissions by carrying out a series of policy measures, including economic adjustment, improving the energy mix, raising energy efficiency, and afforestation. Statistics show that by raising energy efficiency alone, China saved 800 million tons of standard coal from 1991 to 2005, an equivalent of reducing 1.8 billion tons of CO2. China has set the targets of reducing energy intensity by 20%, reducing discharge of major pollutants by 10%, and increasing forest cover from 18.2% to 20% for the period between the end of 2005 and 2010. All these steps show the Chinese government's commitment to tackling climate change. The Chinese government pursues sustainable development as a national strategy and environmental protection as a basic national policy. It believes that environmental problems should be resolved through development and is actively exploring ways to ensure coordinated environmental protection and economic development. China is fully implementing what we call the scientific thinking on development, which puts people first and aims at promoting comprehensive, balanced, and sustainable development. We are endeavoring to transform the inefficient economic growth model, and we are working to ensure balance between economic development and population and resources in the pursuit of harmony between man and nature. China is pursuing an eco-friendly development path to achieve economic development, make life better for its people, and protect the environment. We are committed to controlling greenhouse gas emissions and strengthening our capacity to adapt to climate change so as to play a constructive role in tackling climate change. Ladies and gentlemen, as the impact of climate change is global in nature and concerns the interests of all countries, this issue can only be addressed through extensive international cooperation. Developed countries should face up to their historical responsibility and the reality of their high per capita emissions. They should follow the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities, which is embodied in the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change and the Kyoto Protocol, and take the lead in emission reduction. They should help developing countries improve their capacity to tackle climate change and take the path of sustainable development by providing financial assistance, transferring technologies, and assisting them in capacity building and adapting to climate change. Developing countries, on their part, should take measures in light of their conditions, give high priority to introducing advanced clean technologies, and make their due contribution to tackling climate change. The Chinese government will, as always, promote and participate in international cooperation on climate change. It will continue to take an active part in the negotiations on environmental conventions concerning climate change and biodiversity, and on trade and environment. It will promote international cooperation on clean development mechanisms and technology transfer, take part in other cooperation mechanisms, such as the Asia-Pacific Partnership on Clean Development and the Climate, and support their supplementary role. China will continue to make unremitting efforts to tackle climate change. Not long ago, a leading group was set up in the Chinese Foreign Ministry to provide guidance to China's diplomatic efforts to address climate change. As China's foreign minister, I'm the head of this group. We have also appointed a special representative for negotiations on climate change. This once again shows the Chinese government's commitment to participating in international cooperation in addressing climate change. Ladies and gentlemen, peace and development are the core of our times. We should respect history, address current problems, be future-oriented, and carry out cooperation in good faith. By doing so, we can certainly strike a balance between promoting economic development and tackling climate change, and realize the harmonious coexistence between man and nature. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our panelists. The President of the Republic of Colombia, Álvaro Uribe. Founder of the Valentino Achacdang Foundation, Valentino Achacdang. Minister of Education for the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan, Mohammad Hanif Amir Alborn. Co-chair of the Jolie Pitt Foundation, Angelina Jolie. And ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our moderator, New York Times columnist, Nicholas Kristof.
Thank you very much. We have just a terrific panel on an issue that could not be more important, where you don't get more bang for the buck. And I might say also that it's shaping up as a more auspicious occasion than the last time I spoke in proximity with President Clinton. I was giving the commencement address at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and right at the same time, on the same day, it turned out, 100 yards away, who should be scheduled to speak? President Clinton. So as I walk in, I see these crowds walking in the other direction. And I had taken my daughter out of school, and my 9-year-old daughter, and I didn't want her to see her father totally humiliated. So I said, you know, Caroline, you should be prepared. You may be the only person in the entire audience, because President Clinton is speaking right across the street. And you know what she said? She looked up at me and thought for a moment and said, Daddy, can I go hear President Clinton? So I just want to clarify, President Clinton will not be speaking across the street, okay? Now, we have just an incredible panel with extraordinary knowledge about the situation in conflict zones and in education around the world. President Álvaro Uribe of Colombia. And Colombia is important because it has a number of ventures in rural education underway, and indeed some of those with the help of some NGOs that are represented here. And then Valentino Achacdang. For those of you who haven't read it, the book What is the What is the story of Valentino's just extraordinary life from southern Sudan to here. And it's an amazing saga, an amazing book, and a testament to how important education is. And he is now building a school back in Sudan. Mohammed Hanif Atmar from Afghanistan, the education minister of Afghanistan. And you think, you know, that's an extraordinarily tough job. Well, previously, under the Taliban, he was working for various NGOs and education issues. That was pretty tough. And then Angelina Jolie, best known for her work as an advocate of refugees. Oh, come on. Angelina has done extraordinary, she may not be best known for it, but she has done extraordinary work traveling around tirelessly to some really forgotten places in the world, from really rural places in Cambodia to Darfur, more times than I believe all the Secretaries General of the UN put together, and has been very active. Very active on these issues. So let me start. President Uribe, there are so many issues out there needed in terms of fighting poverty, and we've been exposed to them with health issues, all kinds of issues. Why is education so important for development, and And in fact, I think the reason it tends to get neglected is because it's seen as not so urgent, not a life and death matter on any one day. So why should we be giving this focus on education?
Thank you, Moderator. President Clinton, distinguished panelists, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for inviting me. It is a great honor. And thank you, President Clinton, for this excellent initiative. In Colombia, we have three main objectives in our administration: to consolidate democratic security, to consolidate investment confidence, and to fulfill our social goals. Education is the first in the list of our social goals. Why? Because to sustain democracy, people need to know that democracy gives people the opportunity to ascend in the social ladder. And the way for the people to have mobility, to ascend the social ladder, is education. In addition to that, education creates opportunities for more productivity, more competitiveness, more income, and better distribution of income. We have problems, and we have challenges and tools. One big problem we cannot omit is that illicit drugs in my country is an obstacle for people to have all the opportunities of education. We have many challenges in our country. One is to get, for the year 2010, full coverage in basic education. Now we have 93. The other is to begin with infant education for people under 5. We are only beginning for vulnerable people. The other is to get 6 million Colombians in vocational training, in presential and virtual schemes. The other is to get 34 coverage, 34% of coverage in university education. The other is to provide 46,000 people who have demobilized from the terrorist groups to provide them with basic education, with university opportunities, with jobs, with vocational training. The other is to provide 600,000 displaced juvenile people with education. We have tools. I will mention you the list of some tools, and later on you can choose which tool ask to me about.
Okay.
One tool is virtual education. Other tool is Families in Action, introduced by my predecessor, President Pastrana. Other tool is New School, whose creator is here with us, Vicky Colbert. This is a very important tool. Other tool is to expand the state agency for children welfare to be able to provide food to 12 million children. Now we have gotten 9 million. Other tool is to provide students graduated from vocational training with microlending, with one system we call Bank of Opportunities. When you provide the families with microlending, the family gets tranquility and the children attend the school. These are some of the aims and some of the tools.
Great. Thank you, President Uribe. Minister Admar. Minister Admar, one of my heroes is Mukhtar Mai in Pakistan, who used the compensation money after she had been gang raped to start schools in her area because she thought that the best way to fight extremism and fundamentalism and the values that had led to her rape were precisely to educate people. I wondered if, in the context of Afghanistan and somebody who was there during the period of the Taliban, to what extent is education a force for fighting? I guess what I'm asking is, can schools be as effective in fighting extremism as gunships, for example?
Well, first let me take this opportunity to thank President Clinton and the organizers for inviting us. Second, before I answer your question, let me tell you about something that is very important for us these days in Afghanistan, to see how much our women and men alike value education and why they are doing that. Unfortunately, over the past 14 months that I am the Minister of Education, 115 of my teachers and students have been brutally killed by the terrorists, 40% of them women. In June this year, unfortunately, one of the worst incidents in my life happened, and when the terrorists attacked one of our girls' schools in Logar. Actually, your paper covered that story. And after 3 hours, I went to the school to see the injured girls. Actually, two girls were shot dead. Their teacher and three other girls were badly injured. So I went to see one of the injured girls in the hospital. It was a clinic rather than a hospital. I couldn't stop my tears. So I engaged her in a discussion and said, look, my child, I'll take care of your treatment. She said, I'm not worried about that. What I'm worried about, she turned to me and said, Uncle Minister, about our school. Make sure that our school doesn't get closed. And that was the time I made one of my biggest commitments in life. And I said, my child, whatever I have in my power, I would make sure that your school doesn't get closed. Mm.
And if there had been schools earlier, then do you think that, you know, if those men who committed those attacks, if they had gone to school, would such attacks have been less likely?
Of course, the school was protected by the communities. This is one of our key policies that we are trying to actually give that responsibility to the parents and the communities. We say to them, if you want education for your kids, it's your responsibility to protect them, and we as the government will do everything to support you. And it's not just protection for your school. We want you to manage your schools. We want a new governance system in our education that is people-led, parents-led system. I mean, the question we need to ask is, why are Afghan women and men valuing education to this extent that they are even taking that kind of risk to send their kids to schools, despite the forces of terrorism and what they do so brutally, and still there are these courageous people, men and women, who are sending their kids? There are four key words that I have often heard from them. Education is important for survival. Education is important for peace. It brings peace. Education is important for prosperity. Education is important for having a voice in the system. It's important in terms of survival that the kids of an educated mother have better chances of survival. With women trained and educated, you can deliver the most crucial services, public goods, health and education. It's important in terms of peace because they think that the children of an educated woman will be less susceptible to the manipulation by the warlords and the terrorists, that educated men will have other opportunities rather than serving the terrorists. It's important in terms of having a voice in the system. Yes, Afghanistan is beginning to become a democratic society, but educated women will be able to have a better voice in that system. And it's important in terms of prosperity, that there's no capital more strategic than human capital for freedom from poverty. And that's exactly is their understanding, and therefore it is so much valuable for them to make sure that their kids are educated.
Angie, in that context of education as a force for stability, you've just returned from Iraq and Syria, and you were looking at Iraqi refugee issues. There's concern about the creation of a new large diaspora that is not getting adequately educated, that may be a force for instability. What did you see? Can you give us a little sense of those unfulfilled education needs in that community?
Sure. Well, first I'd like to say in all situations, it's kind of a strange thing. When I was preparing for this, I kind of thought, what are we all going to say? What can I say? What can you say? What can we all say to encourage everybody to understand that education is important? It seems such a unnecessary thing to do. Everybody in this room is very educated, and everybody knows the value of what we're talking about. Children in conflict and refugee children, because they have lost everything, they have nothing, and they have been traumatized, and they have been hurt, and they have witnessed more than we pray our children ever have to see, and all they have left is their minds. All they have left is a possible future, and what are they going to do, and what are they going to be? And if they are, and they are susceptible to so much, and they're feeling so much, and if we can take these young people, who are such great young people, and they're survivors, and they're kids, and give them amazing opportunities and say, we're going to help show you how to learn about reconciliation. We're going to teach you about what it is to be a teacher, a lawyer, an engineer, and we're going to instill in you the knowledge of how to then build your country and have a future. And it's not just that we want them to be these things. We don't want them to be other things. We don't want them to grow up and not have anything to live for and not feel that they're of any use and not know what to do. And then they are subject to anything. And there are many, many schools of people that do encourage very bad behavior that will offer a free lunch and an education. And it is something we should be concerned about. And we don't want them to turn to those schools. So when I was there, there are many, many children out of school. And those who are in school in Syria, there are three to a desk, but there are very few of them that are able to get into any school. And do I have a moment to tell a small story, or do you want to get back to me?
Sure.
Just as the type of the picture of the child that we're talking about. For me, I met two men. I met a young man who had been, for religious reasons, he had been tortured for 3 days. He had been set on fire and thrown in the garbage. He was very, very badly burned and infected. He was begging on the streets. He tried to get into one country. He couldn't. He was attempted to get some medical aid, and squads came in to kill everybody, so he had to leave. He begged his way into Syria, and he was still living as a beggar on the streets, and his burns were becoming increasingly more infected. Ran into a little boy who was also a refugee who was selling tissues because they don't have camps. They have to make a living. They get some kind of assistance from UNHCR, but that's how refugees are living in Syria. So he's selling tissues. And this little boy ended up giving this man a little bit of water, and then he said, could you help me? I'll give you some of my begging money, but I need somebody to help me fix my wounds. And this kid was scared, and weeks went on, and the kid agreed to do it. And they first did it. They unwrapped these wounds. Forgive me, they're covered in maggots. And this little boy got scared and he ran. And the man said he came back. He came back not just for the money. He came back because he was a good kid. When I met them, they'd been together for about 4 months. This kid had been treating this man, helping him, cleaning out his wounds, wrapping him every day, stopped giving him money, just did it because they were friends, and he continued every day to sell tissues on the street. So I said to this little boy, I think he was about 8, you know, you'd be the most amazing doctor one day. You're quite extraordinary. And I watched him undo the bandages and do all these things. And I said, would you like to be a doctor? And he got real upset. And he just said, no, I have to sell tissues. And I said, oh, I'm so sorry, but, you know, if we could find a way, would you like to be a doctor? He said, yes, ma'am, but I need to sell tissues. So that's the kind of kid we're talking about. He's an amazing force for good, and he would be the doctor I'd want. But he's the type of kid that they're not just begging and they're not just sitting there with nothing to do and they don't want to get involved in bad activity. They're great young people, and we need to help them be doctors.
People like that, unfortunately, are falling through the cracks all over the world, especially in conflict areas. But one who, against all odds, did not fall through is Valentino. And I believe that that is in part through a refugee schooling program funded in part by Save the Children and UNHCR. And so if any of you have ever contributed to those groups, then you can feel some pride in Valentino's extraordinary success here. Valentino, could you talk a little bit about your own unbelievable journey and the role that education, give us a window of how education helped shape that journey and led you to be right here tonight.
I'm from South Sudan, and I was born in 1980. 2 years after my birth, a civil war broke out in my country that was fought between the North and the South. 7 years later, in 1987, I was separated from my family, and I walked across 800 miles on foot to go to Ethiopia, feeding on wild fruits and leaves of trees and dodging bullets across unforgiving semi-arid zones of southern Sudan. When I arrived in Ethiopia, I was told about this idea of education. I was not alone. There were over 16,000 unaccompanied minors in that refugee camps who all came from southern Sudan. We were asked to join the schools, and the schools we joined were not regular schools. I began learning letters under a tree, and I had to write on the dirt. I did not have a pen or a pencil or an exercise book, and so were thousands of my fellow country men who were joining schools at the camp of children. I was wondering what all this about education was going to be. But there was one thing that bothers me. It was the fact that I was separated from my family. I did not understand about the so-called education at that time. But a few months later, the UNHCR, the Save the Children, and many other NGOs began to support the education programs in the camp. We began receiving a few pencils and exercise books. Two people had to break a pencil and break an exercise book, and we began to enjoy the idea of education. First of all, I did not even want to go to school before these pencils and exercise book came. All I wanted to do was go back to southern Sudan. But surprisingly, one day, one of my friends came back from school and told me that they were distributing biscuits in addition to pencils. So I went the next day to get my biscuit, and they did not continue distributing biscuit. Now, a few years later, 3 years in Ethiopia, there was another political turmoil, and we had to be kicked out of the refugee camps in Ethiopia. And we trekked across the semi-arid zone of southern Sudan to go to Kenya. In 1992, I arrived in Kenya, and at that point, I had witnessed in southern Sudan the massacres that were taking place, the bombings of the villages, the killings of innocent people. So nobody, you know, I need no one at that time to tell me of what was happening in my country. And my teachers lectured to us that the reason our country is at war was, first of all, lack of education. Many people in southern Sudan were denied proper education. And many people in southern Sudan were being manipulated by policies of the war and the propagandas. And that if we had to change Sudan, we must accept the idea of being educated. I joined my schools again in Kakuma in 1993. The Kenyan government again provided teachers. The UNHCR funded our education. And it was a free school, except that I had to sit under a tree, sit on a stone or on a log, and my teacher did not have a chalkboard or a chalk itself to write on. But we had hopes. Again, donation drops in, relief supplies dropped into the camp, and we began to build our own schools, and we had permanent structures. Right now there are 21 primary schools in Kakuma, where I grew up, and 3 secondary schools. But then it was in Kakuma where I realized that education was not only an important thing in anyone's life, but it was a necessity for anyone who wants to live a better life. Growing up in southern Sudan and in the refugee camps, and being told always that the problem in my country was the Arabs against Africans, it was Muslims against the Christians, and that the North did not like the South, was something that I would have not come to understand had I not been educated. I started reading newspapers and reading articles to fully understand what was the problem in my country. And as I speak to you, if you tell me that the problem in Sudan or in the South and the North was Islamic or Christian against Muslim, I will say no. Because religion had never been the problem in the South. No, I will not accept that. Today, if you tell me that the problems in the South was because Southern Sudanese did not like the idea of even Arabic culture to be taught in the South, I will say no. The problem was the small elites who want to control the country, wanting to stuck into that power, and whoever was opposed to that was attacked. That is why my people became the victims. That is why we lost almost 3 million in southern Sudan for over 21 years. In Kakuma, I joined drama groups and became a youth leader. Through education, I became a peer counselor, and I would even speak to my colleagues who themselves had gone through the same atrocities that I went through. And when I explained just the same story that we had before, someone would say, oh, if you can bear with this, I can bear with it as well. How would I have learned to reconcile someone or to give counseling to someone if it were not because of education? It happened that my flight again to America was scheduled on September 11, 2001. I was leaving behind everything, and I knew that I did not know much about the United States. But there was only one reason I trusted, to go to a new country. The fact that I would speak the language of someone that I don't know. And if I know how to speak English, why do I fear? Where would you learn that if you're not educated? Today I have come to notice that we, as the people of the world, have much in common than we even know. And we can only be able to learn that if we spread education to everyone in any corner of the world.
And Valentino, you not only talk the talk, you walk the walk. Every penny from your book and also Dave Eggers' revenues, they are all going to a school that you are building in Sudan. And I believe that that's still you're looking for a little additional funding, hint, hint. And as one of those many unfunded needs in education all over the world.
Well, I said before that my original flight was on September 11. I was stranded in Nairobi for 2.5 weeks, and I alighted in New York at the JFK on September 25th and found out that due to the new security arrangement, my flight had been changed again, and I was sent to a new place as opposed to being sent to San Jose in California, which I really wanted so much, because I had looked at the map and knew that San Jose was not cold, and I was worried. And I was worried that if I get sent to Fargo, it would be difficult for me to begin a new living. So I began wondering, but I was told that I was going to Atlanta, and I confirmed that Atlanta was in the United States, so that was not a problem. I arrived in Atlanta and began doing a speaking engagement at local schools and colleges. And it was in Atlanta, actually, where I met with Angelina 2 weeks after I arrived. Wasn't that funny? And what I did was that I realized through my speaking engagement that I was not going to be able to tell much about my own life. And I wanted so much to help people understand what was happening in my country, and that continued to happen in Darfur today. So I began to seek a writer to help me write my biography. And I was introduced to Dave Eggers, and we met, we became friends. We went to my first NBA game in Atlanta, where I enjoyed everything but the cheerleaders. It was a new thing to me. Yeah. And after the book came out, I decided that I wanted to be able to give back, that I wanted to be able to make a child in southern Sudan and everywhere smiles, and through that smiles I will feel the fulfillment, and I will continue to forgive my worst past. So we committed the proceeds from the book into building secondary schools in southern Sudan. I visited southern Sudan in December 2003 and reunited with my family. And I went back 2 months ago, and we're going to build a secondary school. We'll begin with the first one in November and aim to build 5 schools. How I'm going to build this school is going to be different. I go and meet with the grassroots people, and hoping that once I begin the school, I'll be able to see the difference I have made within 2 or 3 years, and then I go on from there.
And one measure of the extraordinary unmet need for education in southern Sudan is that a girl in southern Sudan is actually more likely to die in childbirth than she is to become literate. Maternal mortality lifetime risk is greater than the probability of becoming literate for a girl in southern Sudan, which is just a measure of the challenges we face and of the unmet challenges. I think maybe one of the things that Americans perhaps don't appreciate, and you alluded to it, and Minister Otmar did as well, is the attitudes toward education. That in this country, we're used to our kids saying, oh, school, I have to go to school again. You know, we think of, you know, kids not being thrilled at that idea. And on the other hand, if you travel around the world, and you know that at this very moment, there are going to be thousands of kids who are crying right now, because they have to drop out of school because they can't afford a school uniform or a school fee, or because it's too far away, or some other obstacle. I wondered if let me just throw this up, this sense of just desperate desire to get education. Is that something that you have seen, you know, across the board in the places that you've been?
Well, I think we'd all say yes to that one. Absolutely. I think it is a... Oh, it's always... I took three kids to school this morning that weren't that excited about it. You know, it's always very... you know, it is. It's a very emotional thing, especially when you ask them what they want to be. I think we all discover that. You know, I think you ask a lot of kids here what they want to be, and they'll give you actress. Not really the most noble professions. But you ask them there, and they all... want to be great things because they all want to do great things for their countries. And you know, I hear you speak, and I just think, you know, we often hear about your country today. We hear every something today going on with Darfur, Southern Sudan still, and so much. And aren't we lucky that we have men like you that have had an education that are going to do great things and help deal with these two great challenges and help make it better? And I think that is, understanding that is what we're really all talking about, is... And you are that great example, so.
In my country, we find that people are more and more eager to get in education. For instance, we have an institution to lend money to university students. Our aim is to multiply this institution by six. Six times more students, six times more amount of money to lend to them. At primary school, at secondary school, at the necessity for children under five to go to the school, we find obstacles. We need to build more schools, to connect these schools, to enlarge the payroll of teachers, to improve the education, the level of education of the teachers, and we need to provide many families with subsidies for them to send their children to school, and we need to provide the children with nutrition. Although we have improved a lot in nutrition, we also need to provide nutrition to 3 million poor children in our country. This is a challenge for that to come in here. But there is one big problem, one big obstacle against education in our country: illicit drugs. Therefore, we need to defeat illicit drugs, because illicit drugs, the drug dealers, the terrorist groups, lie, for instance, the rural families, that they have to grow illicit drugs, that they cannot send their children to schools. Therefore, we need to defeat illicit drugs, and we need to replace the income for the families. Let me refer to one very important project. Here, we are plenty of donors, and I want to invite them to consider this option for my country. This program is called Forest Ranger Families. Colombia has 51% of its territory still in jungle. Drug dealers oblige families to cut the jungle down and to replace the trees for illicit drugs. What we are doing is to sign contracts with families for them to abandon illicit drugs, for them to keep the jungle, to supervise the jungle recovery. And we pay to every family $2,000 per year. We began this project 3 years ago, and so far we have completed 50,000 families, but we need 180,000 families. This program is under the supervision of the United Nations. It is very effective as a tool against the global warming. And of course, in a country with the long tradition of violence, it is necessary to teach values. We Colombians need to learn how to live in community, how to solve problems peacefully, to teach values. For us to learn values, is very important in Colombia. And to intervene in education, it is very important, the presence in our country of NGOs. We need NGOs at every level of education, and they receive payments from the government, and of course, they need donors to help them get the funds.
Ed, just to follow up on the point you raised about subsidies, for example, you know, I think that we intuitively tend to think of expanding education by building schools, but there has been a lot of research to show that one can also increase education very cost-effectively in many places by having school lunches, for example, as an inducement to parents to send kids to school, 17 cents a day by the World Food Program. Or if you build latrines for girls in schools, then you dramatically increase the number of girls who stay in school. If you deworm kids, that may be the most cost-effective way of all of increasing education. We're just about out of time, but Angie, I'd just like to ask you, for those people who are, you know, interested in pursuing this issue, then how can they find out more about unmet needs that they might want to find out more about?
Well, we're all working together to. I think that is the thing we've discussed, that for children in conflict, as you mentioned, there are so many different ways. There are very special circumstances, whether it be that these are children that have to work, or that these are children that don't have food, and we have to figure out ways with school lunches. So there are many different programs, many different countries, and many different types of needs, security concerns, specific concerns for girls. So the need is all of us. There's not one specific ask. So there is a kind of menu from some of us and from the Education Partnership for Children in Conflict. We're working together, and we're working in many different countries. There is a menu that's been kind of put together. What we've tried to do is look for people already doing great work, trying to put together to explain to you, here's what they're doing, here's who they could help, here's what country, and really try to lay it out as clearly as possible and say, trust us, we've done the research, we know these are good people, so please try to get involved. But all of us here, I'm sure, have different websites and different places you could go, but that is certainly one of them. And please finish.
Yeah. Sure. Actually, I was coming back to that first question.
Very briefly, we're officially out of time.
Actually, in Afghanistan, we don't have the demand problem for education. The challenge there is how to meet that demand. It's primarily about supplies. Teachers, particularly female teachers, is a key constraint there. We have to train new generation of female teachers. We have to build more schools. I mean, only 40% of the 9,000 schools in Afghanistan have buildings. And still the parents are sending their children to schools that are literally in open spaces. And the issue of improving quality through developing a value-based and a relevant curriculum is there. So indeed, what we are trying to do in Afghanistan is actually to harness the generosity of our international partners, as well as the Afghans themselves, and translate that generosity into meeting the critical needs of education in that country.
Well, I think that one of the reasons, the impediments, why people don't act more on this issue is the sense that it's huge and hopeless and just so vast that it's hard to make a difference. But I'd like to leave you with that Hawaiian proverb about, or the Hawaiian story of the man who comes across the kid on the beach, and all these starfish have washed up on the beach, and the kid is throwing the starfish back. And the man says to the kid, "What's the point of this? You can never throw all of them back. It makes no difference." And the kid says, "Well, sure makes a difference to that one." And indeed, it really does make a difference to all those individuals out there. And so I'd like you to please join me in thanking the extraordinary panels, not only for their contributions today, but for their great work on this issue. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, the plenary session is now concluded. Doors will open for this evening's reception at the Museum of Modern Art promptly at 7:30 p.m. Thank you.